The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org.
Writer Dagoberto Gilb is a native of Los Angeles. He is the author of several books, including The Magic of Blood, which won the Penn Hemingway Award, The Last Known Residence of Mickey Acuña, Woodcuts of Women, and Gritos, finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. His essays and fiction have appeared in numerous publications, including The New Yorker, Harper's, The Best American Essays, and The Three Penny Review. Dagoberto attended the University of California, Santa Barbara. He received degrees in philosophy there. And after that, he spent 16 years making his living as a construction worker, eventually joining the union in Los Angeles, a member of the United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners, before winning wide acclaim for his first story collection, The Magic of Blood, in 1994. In fact, the last time Dagoberto read here on this series, which was actually in a program that we held in MoCA's auditorium, I'd learned that he'd been on the construction crew that built MoCA. So it's no stretch to say that he is intimately knowledgeable about the underpinnings of Los Angeles culture, in a true sense. Dagoberto Gilb is much admired for his mix of compact style and socially brazen storytelling. He makes simple, ordinary language and imagery feel exotic and profound. In his new book, which he'll discuss tonight, The Flowers, Gilb takes on the voice of a teenager looking at manhood. The Flowers tells the story of Sonny Bravo, a Mexican-American coming of age and falling in love while living in an apartment building owned by his stepfather. Larry McMurtry wrote, "Dagoberto Gilb is one of the most powerful writers of his generation, and The Flowers is perhaps his best book. It is not to be missed." In conversation with Dagoberto tonight is Los Angeles's own Marisela Norte, one of the most important literary voices to come out of East Los Angeles and a founding member of the East Los Angeles Fencing Club. Norte has contributed to many publications, including Rolling Stone, Interview, LA Times Sunday Magazine, Bomb, and Tu Ciudad. She's performed her work throughout California and many cities in the U.S., and most recently at the Tate Modern in London. She co-authored the play Black Butterfly, Jaguar Girl, Piñata Woman, and Other Superhero Girls Like Me, and she's been honored at the Kennedy Center in D.C. and nominated for an Ovation Award. And I'm very happy to be able to say that her book, Peeping Tom Tom Girl, will be coming out in September from City Works Press. Finally, a book of Marisela's that we can all have. That's great. As I said, after their conversation, we will invite you to join the conversation. So please welcome Dagoberto Gilb and Marisela Norte to the LA Public Library. Thank you.
Thank you, Louise. My jewelry's really noisy tonight. How'd you like that music?
I love the music. What I love when I come to these things is all the praise about me.
What's there not to like, right? Who wouldn't?
I need a lot of that, so it's just...
Well, like, how do you like... I put the book right up there. This is the copy they sent me, and I read it, and I printed out my questions in big font, even though I brought my glasses as backtop. Blah. Thank you all for coming, by the way. Thank you so much. Very much appreciated. What I kind of want to be here on the page, but then I also just want to talk to you because you and I sat on a panel at UC Riverside during Writers Week when we were being writers.
Right.
And
aren't we always writers?
Yeah. But now you're in Fresno now. So what is that like?
It's strip malls.
Is it? I've only been once.
Caro's. It's like, should I go to Caro's or Marie Callender's? And then, you know, my son, who used to work at the Olive Garden, he said, "Dad, all the Chicanos go to Olive Garden." And I said, "Really? No." He said, "Yeah, he worked at it a long time." And he said, "And watch." And so we went to a Olive Garden. And he said, "All the really, you know, like the Chingon Mexicano."
Oh, yeah, you made it.
There's a certain, and I already forgot the name, but they always order this one dish. And next to us was, you know, a Mexican family, and the dude ordered it. It was so funny. He was so right. And it was like, you learn, you know, we've come a long way. We eat at Olive Garden now.
That's right. Well, only in L.A. they call it Olive Gardens. They make it plural. But, you know, you mentioned Caro's, and I saw something really frightening the other day as I was crossing the parking lot. There's a Caro's where I live. And, you know, I see here's, you know, typical Chicano family, right, going to have breakfast on a Sunday. And they're carrying the baby in a coach baby carrier. Has that Chicano coach phenomenon gone on to Fresno or at the house?
No, that's only...
Is that just L.A.?
That's Texas.
Okay. Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Okay. So I have to ask you one of my written down questions, okay? For me, in a lot of ways, downtown is almost unrecognizable at times. I was walking to work, and I saw a young woman, a dog walker. First of all, dogs in downtown. And she had 5 dogs on leashes, and she was getting tangled up and holding her coffee in her hand. And I was expecting somebody behind me to yell, "Cut!" Because I just thought, this is not... You know, L.A., and you're from L.A., and I know you're only here a short time, but what is it that you had the opportunity to kind of revisit, or have you even had that opportunity yet?
Well, you know, the last couple days, I've been here for a couple days, and the first thing I always do, you know, Studs Terkel wrote this book, you know, Working, which mm-hmm. is one of my all-time favorite books, and it was really important to me when I read it, but I think it's the bricklayer that's, it might be the stonemason. And the guy would talk about when he'd go to a job, he'd go back to his old jobs, and there was, when he does a job and he makes, you know, you put in 1,000 bricks or whatever it was, there was this one where he screwed something up and he just screw it and goes, you know?
Right.
But whenever he goes back, he cruises by the job and sees that mistake, like, oh my God, everybody sees how shitty I did that. Which, of course, is ridiculous. Well, what I do, I go back to all my jobs.
Cool.
And I look at everything.
Do a tour for us? Just, can you start with Mocha? Because that's where I'm currently doing time.
Well, let me go to this one that I go to. There's a job at 4th and Hope, which I worked on, this one company, CD Construction. And actually, it wasn't out of their trunk. It seemed like it often, but they had this huge 4-building project, all poured in place, which for a carpenter means a lot of work. And me and this guy named Juan, he was from Chihuahua. We did all these ramps, and we were like important. And we got up, and at about floor 14, 15, the engineers came and said, we're like, you know, this much out of plumb, the building. So we had to shift, and there's like it's probably 3/4 to an inch that the building, I mean, it's tipping like this, exact, and it goes like this. Well, I see that edge. I can still see that edge. And I went over there, you know, this morning, and I looked. I said, there it is. I see it. It's so weird. And the other thing, you know, so a lot of my history with downtown is about the jobs that were good and the jobs that were horrible. I went to a horrible job. It's over here on, I guess it's 6th and Wilshire.
Okay.
And it was one of these jobs where they put me up with the guy that, I mean, he's just an asshole. Let's put it bluntly. He was an asshole. But then when they link you with somebody, you're stuck.
Yeah.
And if you say anything, you sound like you're being like something. And so that job, you know, didn't work out. So I look at that job and sneer. Because I lost the job when I didn't need to lose that job.
Is this the guy they paired you with that kept coming back?
No, that
you
was...
kept telling him, like, get away from me, kid. You bother me. And he would keep coming back, right?
No, that was another asshole.
Oh.
Not too many in construction, you know. But there's a couple once in a while.
Do you ever miss that physical work?
I absolutely miss that physical work. I truly. I mean, and I have like a friend of mine out here. I mean, people will remind me, are you stupid? Don't even think that way. That's horrible work. It's horrible hard work. And it was, but, you know, I'm like the hardest working employee and the worst boss. And sometimes and sometimes I'm the worst employee and the worst boss. I mean, I'm like want to screw around. And then somebody's, I think it's the German part of me that screams like, go to work. Get to work.
But I understand that because I go into restaurants and I think, could I work here? Could I go back to being the freelance waitress I used to be? And could I do that work again? And I did it a few years ago, but you kind of miss that because we're sitting, we're trying to write.
Well, you know, and you only write like two sentences or a paragraph in the day and you think, okay, yeah. I guess I'm not so good at this business. Whereas you can just be totally messed up. I mean, totally a wreck. And go into your job. You put in your, well, in the construction, it's usually 10.
Right.
And you're like honored. You're an honorable person.
Right.
And I miss that because, you know, a lot of the work we do, and we're not getting paid by the week and all these things. Like, I wouldn't pay me today, you know. And, so it's a different kind of work. Like, you messed off all day, dude. What the hell do you think? You think you should get paid? Yeah, I do. I think I should get paid. I really just was off my, you know, I just didn't have the stroke all the way. I punched on the left side well, though.
I thought of you this morning. My bus was going down First Street, and I'm looking at the construction that's going on. It's the new police station across the street from Tom Main's building. And I'm looking at these guys, and it's like the bus is starting to take off. My head's kind of going out the window because I want one last look because I look forward to seeing these guys when they're off their shift. I call it the igloo parade. And it's all these guys that worked hard, carrying their little igloos, right? Like when they were building Disney Hall across the street from us. I can't tell you how many times I would tell the women in my office, let's go look at these guys work. It's beautiful.
Well, then when I was there, I'd always like say, why don't they come and look at us while we're working? And they look at us, ugly monsters, you know, all these things. Like,
but
hey,
there's a beauty there in that, and just kind of watching that work, I think. But anyway, I could never convince them, but that's all right. So I'm going to ask you to please just read, like,
okay.
give me something of the book. I finished it. I read it. I wanted to read it till the last minute. And we'll talk about the characters later. But if you want to read something from The Flowers.
it really wants me to read. That's not a metaphor. Just looked like a metaphor. I have to just bring up this one thing.
Please.
So I was cruising. I went down on Washington Boulevard. My mom grew up at like near Washington and Vermont. And I kind of grew up there, incidentally, because she did, and that's where my dad worked for 49 years at an industrial laundry called Master Linen. And so, you know, I always, like, one of the places I always go, look, my mom grew up right next door. My dad started working there when he was 13. So anyway, I'm driving down there, and this is, like, the stuff that it just struck me. God, I guess L.A. is different. So I'm right there near Washington, Vermont, and there was a young woman at a bus stop. She had on black slacks and a pretty green sweater. And, you know, she's Mexican-American, black hair. And she had this huge, just gigantic yellow, it looked like a rose, I'm not positive.
Okay.
In her hair. I don't know why I just noticed it, and it just like, that's totally different. And I don't know why I brought that up, but it was
No, because I can see her. And
shocking.
I would have wanted to follow her around, you know, and
it was almost like, you know, when you, what's that beer when the tray and they have, you know, that, when it's like a Mexican, it's almost a Spaniard, and she has the red...
Oh, rose. Like Carta Blanca? You
That's
mean those
it.
Old
no,
metal
exactly,
trays?
Exactly. Yeah. It was like that, but I was wondering what she was thinking.
Yeah, what's the
and
story?
And I was wondering if the only place I've ever seen that ever before was in a performance in, like, Sevilla, Spain.
Just super exaggerated.
Yeah, where it was part of the styling. And I thought, wow, that's unique. And I wondered what she got it in... I don't know. Anyway, I don't know what that's all about, but it was such a striking image. I remember thinking, I'm going to tell everybody I saw that today. Maybe she's here. Anyway, I'll just read. I'm going to try to read it. It'll be 10 minutes. So this is the opening of The Flowers. The Flowers is basically titled The Flowers because it's an apartment complex misnamed Los Flores. It's very California-esque. You know, I went to school in Isla Vista, which means nothing. I mean, I think it's supposed to mean something, and then when you ponder it, like, it means nothing. There is no Isla. If it were Spanish, it would be Isla, and a vista, what's that next to Isla for? But anyway, so it's Los Flores, but I realized that if I titled the book Los Flores, people think I was the stupid one. And I'd be spending most of my energy explaining why I was so stupid. And I'd say, if you read the book, it's in there. But so I just decided to just bag that idea. Not that many years ago, I would go to a house in a neighborhood, not always someone's I knew, one I'd never been inside of, where I'd only have to hop a fence, nothing complicated, and from the backyard, I'd crawl through an open window. People always latch the ones in the front, but never in the back, and especially not the bathroom one, you know? And it wasn't so small, I couldn't get in quick. I could have stole lots of shit in those houses, except that's not what I was going in there for. I wasn't like that. Maybe I don't know exactly what I was doing, except I was doing it. I never took nothing much if I did, because I didn't want to. I was more watching how the people lived, imagining how it'd be in their house. I stared at the framed pictures they had of their family. Husbands in suits and wives with necklaces and old grandparents from the other times way before. Unsmiling dudes glaring at you in tilted military hats and coats with medals and ribbons. Full body shots of happy daughters in white veils and lacy, crunchy wedding dresses that poured all over into the bottom of the picture. Shocked little babies on blue backgrounds squinting like, what's going on here? What's all this light shit? Dopey dumb, I'm so proud high schoolers graduating and making a face like they were department store managers. If I felt like it, if I had the mood, I sprawled out on their couches or lay down on their beds, go, how would it be if I lived here? I let that come into me. I let my mind go to the show it liked. Maybe you could say I would go off into my own world until I stopped getting too stupid because, you know, I had to leave and get out of there fast. And once I got up, shook it off, and remembered where I really was, even if I opened their refrigerator, when I looked inside, it wasn't like I didn't think of eating or drinking. I didn't take any, even a soda, thirsty as I might have been. I didn't want them to know I'd been there. Though I kind of opened the fridge door because maybe I do think of, well, like orange juice. It's that I like orange juice. So maybe when there was some orange juice, I might have taken a gulp or two. But see, even then, nobody'd really know. One time I was in this one house, and I was looking inside a drawer in this girl's bedroom. I knew about her because she was this dude's older sister, and she was in junior college. It was that there were a bunch of bras, and I picked them up, and I looked at them, touched them, because I was holding them. Wasn't like I'd never seen my moms and my sisters. It wasn't like I didn't know the difference. It was only that, it was the only time there was something like that, I swear. And I did stop. And yeah, I got all jumpy about it, and it felt like it was fucked up. Real bad of me. And afterward, I only snuck into one more house. Like I said, I didn't know what I was doing it for, and it wasn't like I'd like doing it. Yeah, I did the doubling the font thing to myself. It helps. This one night I was watching TV. I already ate a cheese enchilada frozen dinner, which was crap, and the fried chicken, which I love, but my mom said cost too much. My dog, who I named Goofy because of her floppy black ears, even though she was a girl dog, was with me on the couch after she licked the tin containers all clean, dragging them all around with her tongue, then scratching and biting at her pulgas back near my lap, when all of a sudden she heard something and she was digging her claws against my legs because she was on it before a human ear could, running so fast she was barely able to make a corner turn to the straight ahead for the front door, barking all excited like it was somebody she hadn't seen all day. I didn't hear nothing, probably because I had on that TV and nobody ever knocked on the door unless it was a Mormon or a Jehovah or one of those ex-decatos who love Jesus like their heroin. And I learned to stop opening the door for any of them. Usually I wouldn't even look if I did hear, but because Goofy's barking so crazy, I go. And before I even get near the door, I could feel the pounding on it through the floor, and I heard some man yelling at it loud, and he's beating on it so hard that it's shaking and rattling. I ain't going to answer, but he keeps hitting on the door so much I can't help myself. The words pop out of me that my mom's not here. It was that he was screaming about her. He was screaming like, "You bitch, open the fucking door right now, you thief. You slut, you bitch, open this door, Sylvia, right now, or I'll fucking bust it in." I was standing there, not sure what to say or do next, Goofy all barking and wagging like it was something fun. "Open the door," he says. "Open the fucking door." And without thinking first, I'm talking too. I'm saying no. I'm saying that my mom's not home. I go reach over and check that it's still locked, and I hook the chain thing, backing away from it as quickly as I got close. "Open the door," he says. He was beating on it so that the door was wanting to give in. "Open it." I felt like the whole house was shaking. Finally, I can think for a second. It was hard because Goofy was going all crazy. "She's not home," I shouted. I can think finally, and what I'm thinking is that I know who it is. I'm thinking it's the man I heard her talking on the phone about, that once he shot a man, that he got drunk a lot. This man's voice sounded drunk. "You open the door," he says, "or do you want me to bust it in?" I swear he was slugging the door with his fist, and there was like a crackling wood sound. "Do you hear me, kid? Do you fucking hear me?" I'm whispering to Goofy to stop barking. "Come on, Goof," trying to make her calm, but she's on automatic. It got like she was barking at another dog and wanting to bite. "Where is the bitch? You tell that fucking mother of yours to open the door or I'm busting it in right now. You hear me?" I ran to the kitchen. I had to open a bunch of drawers because my mom never put things in the same ones, or maybe I didn't because I didn't know which drawer either. I found that big knife. It was as long as my wrist, a wood handle. As soon as I grip it in my hand, I don't feel as scared. I didn't care if he carried a gun. He comes in, I cut the dude. Goofy was still wailing at the door, and he was still hitting on it and saying shit, but it seemed quieter to me. I walked back a little slow, and I didn't go near the door, but to the one side of it. I held the big knife in my hand, and I'm gripping it so hard I didn't feel like it was a knife, but me. The man started kicking the door. Then he was throwing his body against it, and you could hear wood cracking. I'm just standing there, and I don't hear Goofy no more, if she was even barking. When the door blasts, splintering the side it opened on, it swung so hard and wild that Goofy didn't move away, and she made a loud crying yelp, getting thrown against the wall, crushed between it and the door. The man was standing outside on the front porch and breathing fast. He rolled up the sleeves of his white business suit and tucked it into his black slacks, and there was some tattoo on his right forearm muscle, and he had on a slippery tie loose around an unbuttoned collar, and he was big. His face was all purple. Real quick, Goofy went back to her barking again, and the man couldn't figure out which of us to look at first until I see him see my knife. His eyes were slits, but I could feel heat and breathing out of them too, and I was standing there maybe 10 feet away, one hand with the big knife loaded in it, the other clenched and a little up, looking ready to jab in a left-right combination. "Watch yourself now, kid," he says, stepping inside toward me. I step back, though not like I was backing off. "You have to put that down right now," he says to me. "You just drop it, okay, kid?" I didn't say nothing. I stepped back once more, keeping the same distance between us. He stepped toward me again. I backed up once more, thinking where a knife should go. Then he went at me.
He was so fast he took me down even before I saw him come, and his hand locked my hand with the knife in it to the floor. He pushed the air out of me because his body was on me so heavy I couldn't breathe. Goofy was growling and biting him, and I was trying to at least kick his nuts, but I didn't do a thing to him, and when I made him roll a little, it made the knife dig into my own stomach. He got onto my back and he pinned me, both my hands pressed to the floor, his knees into my chest, hurting my ribs, the knife not cutting me or him. "Stop," he says, too close to my face. "You gonna stop?" Goofy was back to biting him, and that's when he let go of me, ripping the knife away from me as he stood up. Goofy kept going for his leg until his hard black shoe lifted her jaw and head when he kicked her there really hard, and she whimpered, hurt. I got up once he got off me, and I was crying, and I saw how I was bleeding at my stomach. It didn't hurt or nothing yet. He was standing there watching me for what might not have been such a long time, and then he just turned around and took off out the broken front door. After that, it's hilarious.
That's how you start, right? I gotta tell you, that apartment building just stayed with me because, as a, you know, I love to peep. But you went into, Sonny goes into these apartments, right?
And fictionally went in.
Yes, you fictionally went in. What saved me was my aunt, who was the inspiration for the East LA Fencing Society, of which Luis mentioned. She was many different religions when we were growing up. Well, the summer she decided to be a Jehovah Witness was the summer I got to go with her, knocking on doors, and how do these people live? It's just right. What you nailed it when you said what I wanted was, that's what interested you. Like, how did these people live? I used to think people were rich if they had Tang because the astronauts drank it. So if I saw some Tang in the kitchen, I thought, oh, these people have money, right? But what is that thing about wanting to know how other people live and going in and...
I think it's what we all do. I used to think my dad was rich, you know, because he was my dad and I never saw the guy. And I didn't know really he was the boss of this plant. I thought he's rich. I'd tell everybody right. He was rich. He drove a Cadillac. I thought that meant he was rich. It just meant he was like buying a Cadillac. And but then one day I remember, like, I was sitting there with him and his wife, and they, everything they ate was out of a, like, peas out of a can. She was from Tennessee. It was always so weird when I was there anyway. And I thought, they're not rich.
Right, you know? Right.
They're not at all rich. And, so I think that's what we do. And in fact, in terms of the novel, I think that's what the whole novel is about, is, like, trying to get into other lives and trying to understand other lives. And in some sense, he's trying to, you know, find his own real life, and the house is sort of a metaphor of him, just trying to get out of his own life. I think we're all imagining. Part of the story is he starts learning French, and he wants to learn French. I've even had somebody say that he wanted to learn French because he was, you know... trying to get away from his Mexican, you know, Mexican roots. It's really stupid. I thought, no, he just thought it was funny.
Right. He wanted to learn how to curse in French,
yeah,
too, right?
Just,
he wanted to curse out
just
his stepfather.
Like, whenever he thought something in French, it made him smile.
Yeah.
He thought it was a lot funnier to say anything in French than saying normally.
Right. And somebody thought it was because he didn't want to be
totally
Mexican.
Totally like some deep anti-Mexicanness in him or something. That was funny.
Yeah, what's the real story, right?
Yeah, right.
But I love how you go from apartment to apartment, and I wrote down some of my and I want to get to the cockfighting essay also, and my discovering the Holy Grail. I was more watching how the people lived, imagining how it would be to be in their house. And the character, Sonny to me, was somebody that I grew up with, which was this kid named Mijo. And that was just his name, Mijo. We didn't know his name, right? His name was Mijo. And he was, I think he might have been like a latchkey kind of a kid, but what set him apart is that he would go to restaurants by himself. And I thought, you crossed over into the world of adults, you know, where people eat alone. You know, the whole idea of eating at a counter and not having to talk to...
Damn, I didn't know I was that.
Yeah.
That was me. That was me.
But I love how this kid discovers the bowling alley, right?
Yeah.
And he says it's almost like eating at some... He's befriended by Mrs. Zuniga, who I love that woman. And she feeds him hamburgers and gives him extra... I'm telling you, he wrote right? But she feeds him hamburgers and gives him extra food. And he says it was like eating at someone's house, except there was a bar and a bowling lane and a cash register. I love that. I love that piece.
That's great. Thank you.
No. I
love Mrs. Zuniga a lot, actually. Right? Liked her as a character. I just wish she existed. I can go visit her.
Go hang out at her house.
Yeah.
See, like you said about following around this woman with the yellow thing in her hair, when I see these señoras on the bus, it's like, I want to follow. Like, just teach me how to make one thing.
Right.
And I will be very happy. Let me just go to your house or... I always think that when I win the lottery and I'm driving by bus stops, I'm just going to pick people up and I'm going to have this van and I'm just going to pick up these ladies that should not be walking home by themselves with groceries.
But you won't trust them if they get in, right?
I know. It'd be scary.
Then you're like, okay, you're not the person I thought you were.
It's scary.
It's kind of the dilemma of that kind of stuff. If they like you, you have to question what's wrong with them.
Exactly. But just this image of this kid... You know, eating alone and bowling by himself in a kind of, I guess it was a bar, right? And there's just viejitos there and loners and just really lonely people. But he kind of finds his little niche there.
Because it's like his home. It's his kitchen.
It's better than being
at
that maple table and that table. I mean, it just, Cimencina a little bit right here because I think of that table and just that dread of having to sit and pretend you're a family at that table.
No, that's great. Hard. That means it worked. Thank you.
Yeah, it did. So now, let me see. More questions?
I'll just talk about that. I mean, I did.
Please
have,
do.
I mean, you know.
Please do.
Some of that, you know, I did
then
have.
Oh, because then I go into the teenage part. Go ahead.
My mom married somebody close to that world, and it was like, that's all that stuff is. I mean, the shock of it. And somebody asked me yesterday about something, and I remember, some of this. Is it, you know, like, where do you invent, like, these things? Like, they'll say people, and it's funny because a lot of the writing world now is about invention. In the extreme cases, the Dave Eggers and that whole movement of where it's wild invention. You don't really have to do anything. You just sit there and, you know, it's the world is in your mind. And that's never been anything has anything to do with the writer I've been or want to be or the writers I read. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the way I've been describing is that I'm more of a physical writer. It has to, like, slap me. I have to bump into it or crash into it. And so some things just stick, not because they're intellectual ideas, but, you know, there was a stepdad I had that had that maple furniture. It stuck.
You're there.
And it was just odd to me because I don't think I knew what it was the first time. It was just so strange, and I think in particular... Whatever my mom was doing at the time, I was like, what the hell are you doing? Why are we in this strange world? And that has never been able to go away. And so that's where a novel, you know, has the rest, there's little focal points that have something to do with my life. I get questioned like this a lot, like, oh, you write autobiographically. And I guess because of the Dave Eggers and those that world where everybody invents, I call that colonialism generally, but they invent worlds that they've never been to. And I don't even know how to do that. So, but it used to be traditional, most fiction, even poetry, was based on some kind of experience of something. And so, that maple table, I do remember the first days seeing that maple table were just, it was so odd. Of course, also the fish thing. There was a fish experience. I don't know if that's in there. I might have taken that out in the end.
It just took me to a house that we were obligated to. I don't know why we were obligated to visit these people on Sunday, which is the worst day of the week, to drive to Pasadena, and they would never turn the lights on because the guy was kind of cheap, and we were in this dark house with this ancient TV set that looked like a little aquarium. It had a little octagon-shaped screen. Watching things that my brother and I would never watch at home, like having to sit through Mr. Ed or Ed Sullivan, okay, but having to sit through these horrible programs with these two girls that drank strawberry Kool-Aid where half the glass was sugar and dipping white bread in it, and I was just like losing my mind, like, why do we have to visit these people? Why do we come here? And just everything was off, you know. Everything was just off there.
Well, my worst moment, my mother, you know, she was like, she married this particular man out of complete desperation. Just within a week, she needed to change her name. And so she did. And there we were. And the first really shocking thing, and this actually is that he had a son that was a taxidermist.
Oh, yeah.
And I just didn't even know that existed. And I really just had a whole new world of what those kind of people like. So you stuff them. You know, you do.
Carmen
it
Bates.
Was just so yeah. odd to me. Now, of course, I live in a world where everybody, you know, in that world that, you know, you just, I don't know, you live in an insulated world, you understand it later, but the first times you hear it, it's just so stunning that there are people that are taxidermists and they kill their deer and mount them and they kill their owl and
their pets.
So odd.
Yeah. Well, I love the description of the stepfather's office. Again, I can see that furniture. It's that metal gray public school furniture with the gray with the green vinyl seat, and it's just like jail almost, you know,
right.
And it's very cold, but yet he has these dead animals in that office. And there's the kid in the office kind of sneaking around in his own house.
Right.
And those glass eyes are all staring at him.
Right. They always are staring at you whenever you, those glass eyes always are looking at you. I mean, if you walk away and you go, they're looking at you.
Right there.
I got you. You know, I'm going to catch you. You just quit it. I know you're looking.
So
and here I am, you know, I'm sitting here. One of the things, whenever I do these, I'm like, God, there should be a thing here because I fidget. I am such a nut. And I'm like, damn, there should be a little cover so I can do all my usual, like, boom, 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 and all that stuff. And I'm like, shoot, man, look at this. This is not fair. I'm going to see me doing this. So just don't mind me. I'm going to do this.
It's just part of you.
Yeah, it's just what I do.
But I also wanted to.
I'm a great writer.
The other part of the book, that you know, just this character, this teenage Sonny that's kind of going through his angst and all of his drama, and he falls in love with it. Can I say that? Am I like
sure? No,
feeling?
I can tell everything.
Okay, well he falls in love with, he's sweeping, right, and just the idea of this boy seeing a woman through a screen, you know, a screen door, and this young girl who is almost like the mother of this baby. It's her little brother that she has to take care of, but of course she can't leave the house. She's kind of always trapped in there, and they kind of just look at each other through this screen. I'm already dying, right? And Sonny says, I could hear my heart beating, and it wasn't red, it was blue, which immediately took me to Joni Mitchell, the Blue Album, and forget it.
You caught me. I did that purposefully.
Oh, that again, huh?
Yeah, it was Joni Mitchell when I wrote it. I was
two
like,
words,
yeah.
Joni Mitchell. But you go on to describe this teenage kiss, which reminded me of one of the best descriptions I ever read was this writer named Mary Carr.
Yeah.
That wrote this book called Cherry. And she's describing this kiss. And she said she's imagining in that it will feel like that pearl that's dropped into the green bottle of Pearl liquid. For those of you in the audience old enough to remember that commercial, it's just floating, and it's like, how do you get that feeling again? You never do, I guess. But yeah. Sonny kind of has that. He's just, when he sees their reflection in the TV set,
yeah,
that was just, and they're watching some goofy novella, not really watching it, but he sees them as a couple, and they see that he sees themselves in that screen. I just really.
Well, thanks.
You nailed it there.
So that's the hardest stuff to write. You know,
yeah.
You never know if like this could
is
be.
Is this too?
This could be really stupid.
So what's the test? How do you just throw it out there?
Yeah, you just.
You have to
gamble, and that's it. That's all you're doing most of the time. You're gambling. And but those in particular, and a lot of this, the colors and things like that, mm-hmm. These things, I'm not even sure what they are. I just sort of followed. I mean, I think there's a pattern. I think I could probably, but I'm not supposed to do that. That's for, you know, I'm thinking of Amy Tan tells this story that she wrote, I forget the name of the book, but people would come up and, you know, she had the cardinal points of the Chinese calendar and like, oh, yeah. That's what I did. Yeah. Toilet, exactly.
Yeah. Well, you know that famous, that pre-Columbian statue that's been recreated a billion times in Tijuana and other places of two dogs dancing? The first time I go to Mexico City, 1974, I go and I ask the guy, like, what does this mean? Like, what's the meaning of this? And he looks at me and he says, they like to dance, you know? Like, just calm down, lady. Like, calm out there.
Totally right.
They like to dance, you know? Sometimes it's not for, you just write it, and you just wrote it so beautifully. And I also want to just publicly tell you how much I love the story about your mom, the New Yorker story.
Oh, yeah, thank
that you. I'm going to copy it for you, Jordan. You need to read this story because you got it. You went into that planet of women, and you did it right.
Well, thank you.
No, seriously.
Well,
that's
part of, you know, I've got to.
And I don't know if you've gotten any kind of grief from that. Or
no, you know, I think it was really important because, you know, we as a community went through this phase where just admitting that you were male was troublesome for your career. And, you know, much as I'd say, no, I'm actually a woman. And they were like, nope. And I'd say, yes, I am. Should I get naked? Right? No. Anyway, but there was a period where, like, you couldn't, a man was not allowed to know. And, you know, you go, and I actually was raised by a woman. And basically, my mom was a woman's woman. I mean, she had women constantly around, and I'm more comfortable, and I mean it not as a joke, that I was much more easy talking to women and knew women. And so when I got the opportunity to tell the story of that, I think it helped because it just sort of like, it gives you like, look, I probably know, I mean, I know women fairly well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, none of us know each other that well. At some point, we're all walking around like different countries. And it takes some time to sort of acculturate. And, you know, we might be from the same city. We might even be, you know, but in some sense, you know, she's from Colombia and I'm from Peru, and whatever it is, or I'm from, you know, Alaska. And who knows? It's just you have to figure out what you're. So anyway, I just thought, and I think that period in sort of our intellectual history has passed. I think we're finally.
Thankfully, yes.
I hope. Yeah, I think we are.
Where's Louise? I was waiting for her to give me the seña. Are we good? Really? Because I know, you know, people want to talk to you.
Well, you had to do the cockfighting. You brought up cockfighting.
Yes, I did, because I reread that essay, and I really enjoyed it. I've discovered the Holy Grail, and that's why I'm wearing the Maigayo around my neck. I found a DVD that's cockfighting and stripping, which may not go together.
I think you've moved to a new place.
Now I just have to write about it.
We should talk about this later in a, you know.
Yeah, I don't want to reveal too much. There's a few session. People I want to share this with, and you know, maybe it's not the thing you show someone when you invite them over to, you know, have tea with you, but
fried chicken. When you're having fried chicken?
It's changed my
naked
life.
Fried chicken
it's
eating.
It's truly changed my life because the idea that, you know, yeah, it's scary and it's totally illegal, but of course I've got the bootleg copy near downtown, I mean in near Broadway downtown. But the idea, it's called Gallos y Pollitas, you know, roosters and chicks. And you can't make this up, though,
that's so
you know,
strange.
You can't make this up. But you got grief for that essay, too, didn't you? Didn't people
well, not really. Actually, I mean, not that nobody read that. No, but it's just to say that you like cockfighting is gets you like looks, and but it is sort of strange because anybody, you know, it's pretty common in a lot of rural communities, and mm-hmm. God, there's some, you know, the funny thing about cockfighting, and you know, I'm not advocating, but there's stadiums. There's stadiums. The first stadiums in Rome and in Greece were cockfighting stadiums, and that was the. And you can go. I can take you to a place in Deming, New Mexico, where it's a stadium. You know, it only holds maybe 100 people, but it's an absolutely, you know, like a Roman Colosseum.
Right.
Chaparral, New Mexico, there's a place. There's all these places, and people do this. One of my, like my brother, my closest friend, I mean, he's gone through many, macho periods. But he went in through a you know, raising gallos. And, I mean, his wife was just in pain from it. But, you know, having like 50 pens in the backyard.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it was pretty crazy. But, yeah, there's farmers that just have, I mean, it's really their only entertainment. They're too busy. So on Sunday.
Yeah, like they're too busy working, right?
Yeah, so Sundays they fight cocks.
And the family's there. It's like, yeah.
A family event. It's completely a family event. It's not.
In this DVD is that, you know, I think the last stripper that came out was actually a guy. It was like she was a big girl, right? And so here's this unknown town in Mexico. Here the roosters are fighting and, you know, people are eating and drinking sodas and just kind of having fun. And then the big drag queen stripper comes out and she's dancing to a Robbie Williams song. Like, it just all doesn't make sense. But that's the beauty. That's, at least that's what I'm finding. So I'll get you a copy.
Yeah, no, I definitely am.
I think you might like
fascinated.
It.
Fascinated.
Yeah, why
totally
not?
Fascinated.
So I would, where's Justin? With his microphone. Oh, it's not Justin. Oh, I would like to open this up to questions. If anyone has a question for Dagoberto before we go to the signing.
And of course, we have all the answers.
Yes.
I mean, don't limit yourself to just about anything. You can discuss your sister or your mother.
Yeah.
Doctors are in the house.
Adolfo. Hi, Adolfo. Oh, were you just saying hi?
what's your for the microphone.
Do you know Adolfo Guzman?
No.
Do you know?
I should.
Yeah.
Radio reporter here in L.A.
Oh.
What's your daily routine? What do you do day in, day out?
I don't like those kind of personal questions.
It's invasive.
I mean, I didn't shave. I should have. I realized, but I only have like 12 hairs over here and 11 on this side. Maybe. In 5 or 6 under a year. No, I mean, my writing routine. Lately, I've been sort of like running so much. I just got back from living in Mexico City for 5 months, where I'm trying to reorient my life. I want to live in Mexico if I can do that. And but, you know, I tend to, it just depends on how I'm working and how deep I'm into something. Right now, I'm kind of in a little chaotic period because I'm moving so much. I've been, you know, don't laugh when I say this, but I'm the visiting distinguished writer in Fresno, which is funny. Almost, is there distinguished writers in Fresno?
Who knew? I love it.
It's like, yeah, whatever. Anyway, I'm it, which should tell you a lot. It's funny. But anyway, it's really a great place. And so lately I've been like, I'm there one day and I'm moving. So I've been running. But when I'm writing, I have a couple times a day when I work. And I'm pretty fanatical and consistent. And I've been doing it for so long that when I used to work construction, and you know, the thing about construction work is it's feast or famine. And so you might work like 6, 9 months, and that's a good year. I mean, a good year. Sometimes you go, you know, you're sent to a job from the hall and you would get like a week or 2 weeks and then they lay you off. They need a wall poured or some columns and you don't have any choice. You have to go. And so those years when you just consistently, well, the off time I would let myself be a writer and I liked it. So those were good periods. But, yeah, now the teaching thing, it's confusing. Sometimes that's, you know, it just depends. But I tend to write in the morning and then again at night. I'm into my journals a lot. I'm more of a notebook writer. I love to write in my notebook. It's my favorite. Probably 95% of my writing is in my notebooks. Like, I'm going to write about you guys. How handsome you all are.
Very good-looking crowd. Yeah, I'm notebooked. I don't have a laptop. Everyone's like, are you mad? It's like, it's all longhand. I have to feel it. I don't know.
I really love. Well, the thing I like about my notebooks is that I don't cross out anything. Whereas, as soon as I'm in a, you know, in Word or whatever it is, I tend to not, I'm trying to, I move this, move that, I cheat. I didn't write that today.
Yeah.
You know, And with that other, and then I never read it again either, ever.
What about when people give you fancy notebooks to write in and you don't write in them because they're
so
beautiful?
Oh, I never use those. I
have, 99 cent store.
Mine are like these university ones, and there's, you know, the, what are they, 80 page spiral binders, and I've had them since they're years of them now. And, the beginning ones were when I was a philosopher. When I was writing, treatises. And then I degenerated into what I am today. So, I have such a fetish about it that I have to, I absolutely had to go buy, because I feared that people aren't using them anymore.
And they're discontinued.
Yeah. And,
right.
And so I buy 25, and I figure if I use two a year, that's 12 years. And then when I see them, I buy 10 more. So, I have a 30 years back.
No, that's...
I bought a room for them, a bed.
I came across it had Spider-Man on the cover, this little spiral notebook, right? But it was misspelled. It said Spader-Man, and I should have bought more. But it meant I didn't have enough money. I had to buy spray starch at the 99. I couldn't do it. And of course, Spader-Man is gone.
Oh my God, that is sad.
Aaron,
I was wondering if you spoke to your fellow construction workers about writing, and if you did, what was that like? And if you didn't, what was that like?
Never. And, it's funny, I never brought it up. There was a time after a few years, there's this period where you go through, am I just bullshitting myself that I went to school? Mm-hmm. Because you've been there so long and you know that nobody, they think, you should have graduated high school, dude. And, and I'm like, I have a master's degree. And in my head, I'm like, I have a master's degree, And I'm like, God, I think I do. I don't think I was just high. And it gets you have those days you just I cannot believe, because how little things yes, I did do that, that sort of thing, and then a whole period of your life is seems so hard to believe. But no, I actually never once told anybody. And not that, because then once you open that door, at least this was my theory, and I actually still think it's right, once I opened the door, they'd think I was nuts. And then, the other thing is anytime you tell anybody, they're telling you things to write anyway. And I couldn't imagine. It just takes the whole thing out of it. And what I really loved about working construction, and I still miss it, is just being judged for my hand, my work, my ability as a human being. Basically the only intellectual references were TV programs. And I could basically kind of keep up. Just not even tell them that I missed the McNeil Lehrer show last night. And if you did, it was like, you're weird, dude. You listen to that? Not just accidentally. It's stuck. The channel's stuck, man. I can't change it, and it's just stuck there. I have to learn about whales and shit, and I really kind of want to go to The Price is Right.
That's funny. Question back.
I'm not exactly sure how to phrase this question, but I'm always intrigued in the process of writing in the original language, and you write so beautifully in English. When you move to Mexico, are you going to be writing in Spanish? Is that something that intrigues you?
I write emails in Spanish. But, no, it's funny. No. So the answer is absolutely not possible. But, because there's this sort of it's almost, I wish I could think maybe in 10 years, I just don't think you acquire, especially a literary language. I can't read García Márquez. I can't really read it, even if I look up all the words. It's just not right. One of the things that's really funny, and the National Endowment of the Arts has asked me to read in Spanish text, for some prizes, and saying that's just I could probably read them, but that's ridiculous. That's asking a kid in the United States who, let's just say he's in high school, to compare, from William Shakespeare to William Faulkner and to this and say, okay, which is the one you should give the prize to?
You know, it's like not, it's just completely unrealistic, even in English. They don't know. And, you know, it's just not, it's just sort of a naivete and that people even have about, you know, Mexican-Americans, Chicanos, even if we have our little 6, 7, 8-year-old Spanish that we're good with. I mean, it's kind of foolish to think that, you know, I can read the newspaper, and I like to read the newspaper, but I don't, but I do write, you know, I have a couple people I correspond with, and I enjoy it, and I wish it would be fun. But some of what I do, and I've tried to do a little in this book without, is sort of use it as though, you know, there's parts in this where they're talking in Spanish, but I made it English. But I sort of like make it, it's all in English, but it's like as if you were hearing it in Spanish, in real Spanish, and not like that Hemingway, for whom the bell tolls, Spanish. What hour is it? Oh, I think it tolled at 5, you know? And so I try to do that, and but it would be fun to try. I mean, I wouldn't, but no, I wouldn't even presume.
I wanted to ask you, where were you when you wrote the book? Were you Mexico?
No, I was.
Texas?
Yeah, mostly in Texas.
Just Rafael Chabran, Whittier College. That last question, what about Texas? I have some friends in El Paso, I have some friends in San Marcos. They think of you as a profoundly Tejano writer. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, you know, that's a funny thing. That's kind of nice to hear. When I used to live in Chuco, in El Paso, I was the LA guy. And then when I come here, I was the guy from El Paso. Right. And I'm like, and I'm still like here, you know, I'm... If anybody looked at my stories, half the stories are set in L.A., but in L.A. nobody knows anything about that I've written a story set in L.A. This book doesn't mention L.A., but anybody that lives in L.A. should know that it's L.A. But I don't know. It's just people do that. But I attach, you know, I definitely am fond of Texas. I love my community of Texas, not Texas, all of it. I live in Austin right now, And I mean, everybody loves Austin. It's just one of those great cities. But I don't want to live there, really. And I'd much prefer living in El Paso or in the Valley. But speaking of that, I did do an anthology called Hecho en Texas. And I'm very proud of that, and I can talk about it because I didn't write it. I just collected a big anthology. And why is that so valuable? And I'm hoping that it gets copied all around because... Our community is just so, there's so much segregation of information. We are treated like it's just completely a South African experience. And it's just not acknowledged. It is completely ignored. And it is the sort of racism that Mexican Americans get. And because it's not so angry, it's a passive sort of invisibility and unimportance. That it's hard to sort of bring it up. People don't, and it's always nice, and the sort of, in terms of my own career the last 25 years, I've always been like a young kid with potential. And that when you're a young kid with potential, you take it as a compliment, and then after, like, yeah, wait a minute, how do I don't know how to spell Guggenheim. Yeah, no, okay, Guggenheim, G-U, I can't do it. No, I mean, but... But Hecho en Texas is this anthology because finally you have classes, and in Texas they're very proud. It's very proud of being Texans. And at the University of Texas, for instance, they'll have a class on Texas literature, which will fill, you know, 75 to 100 kids go. And there'll be 3 or 4 Chicanos that sit in the back. And I've taught there, and you'll get kids in that in a creative writing class, you know, until I took that Texas Lit class. I never thought I'd want to be a writer, but now I want to be a writer. Well, the Chicano kids just kind of disappear. You never see them again. Mm. And it's because we're never taught. There's no affirmation of the community. And in places like El Paso or the Valley, in the Rio Grande Valley, where the community is completely brown, it's the schools are 99% Mexican-American, you go there... And when they have English, they think it has nothing to do with where they live.
It's something those other people do. And one of the things that I wanted Echo to do, and we're still working on it, and it's kind of been being, it's become a bit of a movement in Texas, is so that there isn't like, you know, the Chicano Week, Mexican American Week, and in the 80s it was Rudolfo Anaya, and they'd read Bless Mi Ultima, and that would be the end of that. Now it's Sandra Cisneros. That's the only one everybody reads. And here are all these people in communities that are, there's 14 up to 38 weeks, 40 weeks a year of school, and they get 1 week of this one person that's acceptable or whatever they've just decided. Well, Echo is an anthology of all these people and a book. And part of the thing that happens when kids are in school, like somebody will always say, hey, you know, you should be a poet. Here, look at this, and it's a Xerox. Well, because it's not in a book, it just does not have the importance of a textbook. We're in a textbook. And when we go and we do these events and show kids that we come in all shades, we come in different sizes. Some of us are skinny. Some of us are fat. Some of us have brown hair. Some of us have black hair. Some of us are somber. Some of us are stupid. They get the idea that just like Irish people, he's like, Irish people are poets because they're constantly taught their own poetry. They're proud of their poetry, and they're proud of their culture. Well, our culture, because it's a self-perpetuating cycle, we don't get enough teachers because we never have teachers. They think that art and poetry and literature is sort of like mathematics, and we'll get a few. We will get a few that study mathematics just like we do, but it's not something that, and so they'll teach, maybe we'll get a Chicano that teaches Faulkner, and that's great. But it isn't just teaching the other. It isn't teaching British literature or South African literature. It's also sometimes to understand where you come from, you need to have your feet. And the soul, our soul isn't some oblong that is close to the brain. It's really someplace else. And I think your soul touches the ground. And one of the things they think is like, where is the poet? You know, you talk to kids in McAllen, for instance, and say, where... When you think of a poet, where is a poet? Well, the poet's flipping a scarf in New York City. And they just have no idea that where they are standing and the stars that are around them and the earth that they live on has poetry on it, because they're never given the opportunity to see. We have this in us. It's really interesting when you live in Mexico how proud they are. I mean, we're the same people in some sense, just we've been extracted and, you know, and all these things, but you just cross the border and the pride in their own community. Carlos Fuentes is coming here. And I know there's just a huge mass. He's popular. He's not half as popular as in Mexico as he is here, ironically. But they're so proud of their writers and artists. It's just a constant discussion. And then you cross over and, like, we don't exist. We absolutely don't exist. So anyway, I'm proud of the community and I'm really happy about it. I get angry. I get tired of the discussion. I have never been somebody that felt that I was a sort of an advocate of a community. It was just not my calling. It wasn't something I saw myself doing. I met somebody last night and I went to UC Santa Barbara. And she was saying, well, you know, I was there in these years. And I said, well, she said, what did you do? She says, oh, I studied, like, you know, he took Chicano studies. And I said, I didn't study Chicano studies because I went to two classes. And I'm like, I already know that we're from East, we live in East LA. And I kind of wanted to know what a Chinese person thinks. I'm like, here, I was interested in Chinese philosophy. I wanted to know, what Spinoza think? That was what I went to. And it's odd, and we shouldn't have to be like that. Anyway.
Yes, somebody back here.
Hi, Dagoberto. I'm from El Paso, Texas, actually. And I read your novel, The Last Known Residence of Mickey Acuña. And just to let you know, you know, coming from Texas and familiar with everything you've just been talking about, I felt really disenfranchised about my ability to write about a place like El Paso because it seemed very mundane and trivial and just compared to, like, I mean, Faulkner wrote about his background too, you know, but reading your novel really helped liberate me from that constraint, that sense that El Paso was somehow not worthy to write about. And it, you know, it really liberated me as a writer, and I wanted to thank you for that.
Thank you for saying so. I appreciate it.
But over and above that, I was just curious, having lived there so long and actually having spent a lot of time studying, oddly enough, fencing at that YMCA. I was just curious, how autobiographical was your experience there? And because it seems sometimes like maybe it wasn't all about El Paso, just knowing it as intimately as I do. So I just was curious about that.
Well, you know, it's like, in a certain sense, you're absolutely right. It couldn't be all about El Paso, because there's no, like, L.A. novel, just like there's no New York novel. There is no such thing, like, there's no such thing as a Mexican, and there's no such thing as an American. And it's almost impossible once you really look at it. But it certainly was a certain part of El Paso in that it's directly on the border. And that right there is a huge metaphor, to be on a border. And it happened to be in a Y, where there is a mental border. Part of the story is about a mental border. But, and so I think, you know, I just confined myself just like in an apartment complex. This isn't West L.A. It's, you know, it just can't be. I can't do it. I didn't even know. I thought I grew up in West L.A. at one point. And I was on a high rise in West L.A. looking down, and I was like at the 16th floor and looking down and like, those are pools. And all these people have pools. I never saw a pool in my life. Like, and you know, my own sense of geography is so screwy. And in terms of El Paso, there's so many different neighborhoods there that, and again, you're just reflecting the sort of like the lack of information that is coming to our community there. It's astounding. And the more I have, the last few years, I have just watched the way kids get into graduate school, and it's truly astounding. And anyway, I might go out fighting, but it's hard because we're, you know, it's a difficult discussion and people don't seem to get, and we're in such a horrible era, these last few years, this anti-immigrant era, that we do these events in Texas, Echo en Texas events, where we bring music, Santiago Jimenez, David Garza plays, we do some poetry, we do different readings, and it's a good show. And I probably shouldn't say this, but for instance, we're doing one in Dallas at the Latino Cultural Arts Center in May, and we were supposed to do one in Irving, and the mayor of Irving wanted us to do it, but he decided he couldn't do it right now because he has an election. And, you know, it's like, wow, this is the era we're in, that you're afraid of supporting not only, it's Mexican-American culture that you live in. You eat tacos, you eat our tacos, you like our enchiladas, but you don't seem to want us around unless we're sweeping. You know, we wax the floor really good.
Are we good?
I think that was it.
So
I don't know if I answered the question. That's
just it's okay.
That's completely what I do always.
So tomorrow you're at UCLA.
UCLA tomorrow.
And then Friday you're at Martinez Books and Barbershop.
Santana.
He's going to offer you a free haircut. Don't do it, because he does this thing where he's just kind of waving the scissors around, but he doesn't cut one hair. Yeah. But he'll offer you. He will offer you a free haircut.
Yeah, I haven't seen
Barber / bookseller.
Yeah, no, I've been there a couple times.
Yeah, he's hilarious.
Yeah, I let him cut my hair one time, and that was it.
¿Te lo cortó?
Yeah, it was terrible. It's really a good idea that he went to the books.
Because I know you're going to be, I'm telling you. You said he would do that with my hair's the same length, right?
Yeah, he just had to quit.
Yeah, but he still has the chair there for posterity. I know you're going to be going to a lot of cities, so I got you a Los Tigres del Norte phone card. All right, so.
Well, thank you.
Just, you know, in case you need to make some calls or anything, so.
She really did.
No.
That's great.
Son los jefes de los jefes. So thank you so much, man.
Thank you, Marisa.
I love the book so much.
Thank all you.
Thank you all.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.